Hey, welcome to Behind the Knife, the surgery podcast. I'm Jason.
I'm Kevin.
I'm John.
And I'm Scott.
And we have a great show for you today. Let us know what's on the OR schedule for the day.
So today we have Dr. Melina Kibbe of Northwestern University, and we talk about something that every single general surgery resident and staff at one point had been involved with in their lives, and that is the art of publishing. And she gives us a great behind-the-scenes look at everything from writing a journal article to finally getting it published. The patient's on the table, the timeout is done, so let's get rolling. Dr. Steele, take us away.
So welcome to another episode of Behind the Knife, and we're thrilled to have our first repeat guest, Dr. Melina Kibbe, who is the professor in surgery and vascular at Northwestern University Feinberg School of Medicine, and is the Edward G. Elcock Professor of Surgical Research. She's a vascular surgeon. She's also the editor-in-chief of JAMA Surgery. Melina, welcome back to Behind the Knife.
Oh, thank you so much. I'm delighted to be here.
So one of the things that we wanted to focus on specifically with this episode is a look behind the scenes in terms of publications, the editorial process, manuscripts, and really focused for the academicians and those pursuing academic surgery. So that's the goal of this entire topic. I guess we'd like to lead off to say, what first got you interested in research?
Oh, gosh, that... That dates back to my undergraduate years when the first summer between your first and second year as an undergraduate, I did a summer of research and I literally was just hooked. I loved the process and it was really just continually exploring, doing research through, you know, many other summers in undergrad and medical school that it just solidified my interest in research.
So I guess a good place to get started, Dr. Kibbe, is just, you know, for, you know, maybe the residents out there that are just getting started, maybe they're, you know, early on in the residency and they want to get started in research. What are just some overall, overarching high points of writing a good paper? How do you write a better paper? And what pitfalls should you avoid in this process?
Yeah, so I think it's a great question. So there's a lot of different answers that I can give you, but if I'm going to kind of address the highlights, I would say, one, know your topic. It's really important to know your topic because you can't really express your research. And by the way, research here is anything from the traditional basic science and translational to health services, outcomes, education, global research, global surgery research. So I want to make it clear for this entire interview that that's what we're talking about. It's really everything. But you can't really communicate your research if you don't know your topic area. So I'd say that's very important. Number two is when you're writing, it's really important to tell a story. I think that often people put so much time and energy in telling a story when they're giving a presentation at, say, a national or international meeting. You need to have that same commitment to storytelling in writing a paper. And I think that all too often when I see younger writers writing, they kind of are a little too stressed out about getting the paper written that they can't take a step back and just enjoy the process of storytelling, if you know what I mean.
Ma'am, has that become an issue? This is John McClone, by the way. I'm one of the research residents here at Madigan. Has that become an issue when you have multiple authors, you know, as a piecing a paper together?
So that's a good question, especially in this era of team science and multidisciplinary research. I think there it's still traditionally you'll have a lead author who's going to write the majority of the manuscript. And I have a lot of team science that I conduct myself through my own lab. And what happens is that while you'll have a lead author, the lead author may get different excerpts or different portions of the manuscript being contributed from different people. But you really need one person to write the entire manuscript to make sure that it's cohesive, it's written in a similar style, and it's telling that story. I have seen manuscripts from my own group where, you know, somebody might try to, say, write the methods and the results, and then a different person might do the intro and a different person might do the discussion. You can tell. When you look at those manuscripts, you can tell because they are not cohesive. So I would really recommend that everybody stick to, you know, having one person take the lead and making sure that it's a cohesive manuscript and telling a story.
Yeah, I remember actually, you know, when I first started, you know, kind of getting involved in research, that was one of the advice I think one of my chief residents gave to me, and it kind of always stuck with me, is when you first start starting a project, and I'm curious to know if you agree with this, when you're first starting a project, it's very important to clearly define everybody's roles early on. Like, who's going to be first author? Who's going to be second author? Who's going to be, you know, the last author? And that way it kind of naturally falls into alignment where there's one person that kind of has the dominant voice. But I was wondering how you, when you're working with a group like that, how do you deal with kind of the group dynamics there, or how should one respond if they disagree with the co-authors or the senior authors on the project?
Very good question. So I agree completely with what you said earlier, that it's critical when you have multiple teams or multiple individuals that you identify the roles early. That will help to prevent the problems that you just described. But let's say you do have a team and you have multiple different authors and there is disagreement on either how, let's say, the results are presented or how the results are interpreted or disagreements on methodology or statistical design. I have been involved in all of the above. I will say that it's important to have an open dialogue and to not, you know, bury this or fester over it, but to have an open and clear dialogue with everybody involved so that you could resolve the problem. And typically, if you still can't get to a resolution, that is the job of the senior author, is to really resolve the conflict in a fair and balanced way.
Melina, I'd like to look at this a different way. And what do you think about in terms of the problem with ghostwriters or ghost authors?
Yeah. Well, let's just talk about authorship. So authorship is still to this day one of those really sticky issues. And I find that all the people that I write with, you know, when it comes to discussing who's going to be first author or the order of the authorship or senior author, I find that in particular, you know, the postdocs and residents are really kind of shy and hesitant about discussing that. So again, I have a policy where we talk about it right in the beginning of a project. We identify who's going to be first, who's going to be second. The middle authors don't matter as much, but then I tend to order, after second author, I tend to order them still by their contribution, the amount of work they put in, etc. And then senior authorship, let me tell you, that's also very important. In today's day and age, you can share first authorship, and you can also share senior authorship, which is really good for team science, but I've still found conflict when it comes to who's going to be listed first of the two or who's going to be listed last of the two senior authors. So again, really important to identify this at the beginning of the project and also document it, because I've had issues where we've agreed upon it and then it's come up 6 months to a year later where all of a sudden the memories are different among the individuals. Mm-hmm. So if you document it, say in your lab notebook, you document it in an email to the entire group, I think that that really avoids this problem. Now, authorship criteria. So I think in today's day and age, it's much easier than it used to be, say, a decade ago, because there are published guidelines on this. So the ICMJE, the International Committee of Medical Journal Editors, has their guidelines, and it's been revised in 2013, and most journals, I would say most, not all, have adopted, and it's basically you have to meet four criteria. So you've heard criteria number one is where you have to make substantial contributions to conception or design of the work, or acquisition, analysis, or interpretation of the data of the work. So any of those. And then you need to be involved in drafting or revising of the manuscript and final approval, and you have to be willing to be accountable for the work in a public forum. So I think it's much easier in today's day and age to actually define authorship criteria and who should and should not be an author. The era of guest authorship, ghost authorship, that era is gone, and it really should not be happening anymore.
So that's all well and good.
I'll just add that many journals have even adopted where you have to actually, you know, either through check boxes or, you know, some process through the submission, where you actually have to say the different roles of all the different authors.
So what do you say to the people then that their department chief or their boss comes up to them and said, "Hey, those are my patients. You're going to put me on that manuscript, right?" And they're relatively junior in their career. And you know, again, what's right and what should happen? I bet you, I would be amiss to not think that still happens occasionally. What advice to give in that situation?
Yeah, I agree with you that unfortunately, I think that there is some of that still occurring, but it's much less today than it was, say, 5 years ago, and even much more less than 10 years ago. I think it's hard for a junior faculty member to say something. So my advice in those situations is that if a junior faculty member is under pressure to include a senior faculty member, such as a division chief or their chair, and they don't feel right about it, what they should be doing is seeking help through, say, a mentor. And hopefully they have more than one mentor, because I would assume that one of those, you know, senior people who they're being pressured to put on is one of their mentors. The junior faculty member should not be put in the position to deal with it themselves. So they need a more senior mentor or friend who could help them address this. I myself have helped several residents and junior faculty with this very issue. So I will step in and I will communicate with the other senior faculty member what is appropriate and what is inappropriate. And I hope that other people are doing that too.
Yeah, ma'am, like Dr. Steele just mentioned, you know, what are your overall thoughts on having a lot of authors on a single paper? You know, when you see a study, you know, have like, you know, 20 authors on there, what are your thoughts when you see that?
Well, I think it's getting less and less, and many journals now have limits on the number of authors that you can include. However, with this era, again, of team science and multidisciplinary collaborations, sometimes it's truly justified. And so you might have 10 or 12 authors or more, and you simply need to justify it in a letter to the editor. 20 is a little hard to swallow unless, you know, that is a large prospective randomized clinical trial that had a lot of people truly involved in the actual study design, etc. But I think we're seeing less and less of that.
So when, you know, there's so much pressure now, you know, with all the available journals and with more and more people getting involved in research early on, there's a lot of pressure on, you know, very junior people to have publications and papers out there. And maybe people who don't have a lot of experience with research, how can one kind of self-regulate themselves and avoid, you know, spinning the data in order to in order to get a paper out there?
I would say just don't do it. So that's an interesting question that you ask. And you're right, we have a lot of that. So we've got a lot of the salami slicing, a lot of the meat extending, a lot of using a different database to look at the exact same question. I mean, there's a lot of that out there. And I would just hope that, again, as you know, residents, as trainees and faculty members are progressing through their career, I hope they have good mentorship, and they learn not to do this. Because you're right, we've just got too much wasteful publication out there. So I just say, don't do it. Don't do it.
Can you explain those terms, the salami slicing, meat extending?
The salami slicing is kind of what folks in the publishing world would refer to as where you have a bigger study, and then you decide to break it down into smaller parts and say, oh, well, instead of one manuscript, I could actually get three manuscripts out of this. And so that would be salami slicing, or some people would refer to that as the least publishable unit. I've actually seen an abbreviated LPU, the least publishable unit. And so, again, that's something that you want to avoid. And meat extending, particularly in surgery, a good example is, let's say you have a clinical database of doing esophagectomies, and you publish on your first 500 patients. Well, when is it considered acceptable to, say, publish on the next subset of patients? You know, you've done 500. Can you publish the outcomes after you've done 600, 700? How long do you need to wait? So meat extending is taking that database, adding a couple extra patients, and publishing again. In general, I think the rule of thumb that many editors have been using is about a 50% increase in your number. Another example would be given you're following patients for a therapy, whether this is a clinical trial, randomized or not. You publish the one-year results. Can you publish the two-year results, the three-year results? When can you publish it? So I'd say in general, 1 year, and then 5 years is definitely acceptable, and 10 years. If your results show something new at the three-year time point, then I think many would agree that that's okay.
How are the journals, kind of coping with this or dealing with this? Is this something that I'm sure it has to be on their radar? But like you say, I mean, you do a PubMed search in the last 10 years, the number sheer number of research out there has gone up exponentially. And part of that's a good thing, but then, part of it's, these other things. So how are the journals on their side of it dealing with this?
Yeah, I would tell you that the peer review system, while it does have some flaws, the peer review system works very well for this. So in general, it's the reviewers that will be pointing out to the editor that this is either redundant with prior publications or this is a salami slicing, meat extending, etc. The reviewers are very astute at picking up upon this. Even also things like duplicate publication or, I saw this, presented in a different manuscript or sections of this. And reviewers are even good. It always shocks me. They're good at picking up plagiarism, too, without using the software. And then I would also say that it's the job of your editorial team, to really look at these manuscripts and make the decision of, is this really new content that you're adding to the publication arena? That is the job of the editor.
Now, Dr. Kibbe, I'm a new research resident, and I started getting into writing some more papers and manuscripts. And, when I first started doing this, I wasn't sure exactly how to do it. So, what I did, I Googled it. Is there any good resources out there you found for reference of how to write papers?
Oh, you teed that question up for me. So I have to actually plug one of my own publications. So a few years ago, I've been giving a talk for the AAS, the Association for Academic Surgery, on how to write a manuscript. And after giving that talk in several different international arenas, I was actually asked to write it up. So I actually published a manuscript called How to Write a Paper. And it's a short, concise, 3-page manuscript of really kind of delineating one method that I use to write a manuscript. And it's actually been a very well-cited, downloaded and viewed manuscript. So it's in the Australia-New Zealand Journal of Surgery in 2013.
I'm going to have to find
another, that. Yeah, and another resource I want to give you is not necessarily to plug me, but this is actually to plug a collection of work from different editors of surgery journals, was the year that I was president for the Association for Academic Surgery, I put together a session at the Academic Surgical Congress on publishing, and I assembled a panel of editors from 5 surgery journals, and it was a wildly successful session. At the end of it, I asked the 5 editors to basically write up their portions, of that session, and then I put this together, as we described earlier, as one cohesive manuscript, and that's published in Journal of Surgical Research in 2013. It's called The Art and Science of Publishing, Reflections from Editors of Surgery Journals. And what I find really helpful of that is it's really a behind-the-scenes of what happens for the editorial process, all the things that we're talking about, editorial misconduct, if you want to get on an editorial board, how do you do it, the issues between open access journals, why manuscripts get rejected, etc. So I'd say together, the How to Write a Paper manuscript and then the Art and Science of Publishing, both of those are really good resources.
Perfect. Thank you.
Great.
So let's go back to the manuscript itself. I'm an author. I get the comments back. How do I go about, A, responding to those reviewer comments, and then how do I revise that manuscript?
Great question. First off, when you get your comments from the reviewers, read it and then put it away. Do not start writing your responses to the reviewers immediately. Definitely put it away for at least a day or two and then come back, because I guarantee you, more often than not, you're going to get a little upset when you read it. So my point there is that when you write your responses to the reviewer comments, tone is really, really important. And the reason is let me explain to you the process. So when you get a decision on a manuscript, it's usually accept, minor revise, major revise, or reject. And journals have different iterations of that, but those are the general categories for the decisions. If you get a major revise, what that usually means is that when you revise the paper and send it back to the journal, it is most likely going to go back to the exact same reviewers that peer-reviewed it the first time around. So if you, let's say Dr. Steele was the one who originally reviewed the paper, and all of a sudden now he's re-reviewing the revision. If the authors took a disrespectful tone or started arguing with Dr. Steele's comments, do you think Dr. Steele is going to be inclined to want to recommend accept? Probably not.
Absolutely not.
Yeah.
Don't mess with me.
Is really, really important. And it's really important to be respectful. You can disagree, but you need to do it in a very respectful way. So the specifics of responding to a revision are this. So number one, pretty much all journals do this. They want you to copy and paste the reviewer's comments. Literally, copy and paste it. So reviewer number one, copy and paste it. They have 10, you know, questions. Then after each numbered comment, you need to respond to their comment and indicate how you are revising the manuscript according to their comment. And this is where I personally see with JAMA surgery some people who don't quite understand. You can't just respond to the reviewer's comment. You must indicate how you are revising the manuscript. And sometimes people forget that. And then you need to do it again in a very concise and respectful way. And keep your tone positive. So that way, using Dr. Steele again, when he reads the response to reviewer comment, he's going to go, okay, they were respectful. They basically revised the manuscript according to all of my recommendations. This is great. I'm going to recommend accept. So you see how that works? So there's definitely a strategy. I see this, and I see it. I mean, it's so predictable which manuscripts, you know, the reviewers, when they re-review it, like versus don't like.
Great. So let's take it to the next level then. Let's say I've been asked to be your peer reviewer. How should I approach that? How should I peer review, or how should I approach that process of peer reviewing another's manuscript?
Yeah. Okay. A couple things that are important here. So when you start as a faculty member, start getting invitations to peer review for journals. If these are journals that you've think in the long run that you would like to say be on their editorial board, what you need to do is you need to accept those invitations to review the manuscript. Now, what I'm going to tell you is true for almost all journals. We track the reviewer performance. So we track so many variables. We track the number of invitations that go out. We track how many you agree to do versus how many you disagree to do and reject. We track the length of time it takes for you to respond to the email invite. And we also then track how many days it takes for you to send your review into the journal.
Wow.
So then, yeah, so every reviewer, we've got spreadsheets and statistics on all the reviewers. So then when it comes time, which is either once a year or twice a year for the journal to determine who they want to put on their editorial board, they look at these statistics. So if they see someone who's accepting 100% of the invites to review a manuscript, and they're accepting them within a day or two of the email going out, and then they're submitting all their reviews on time, and then, of course, the reviews are appropriate and constructive and objective, then, yeah, those are the people who are going to get invited to be put on the board. It is surprising to me how many faculty members don't understand this. I myself have had faculty members that I have mentored, and I would send them invitations to review manuscripts. And I remember one instance, a wonderful faculty member, but this person was new in their job and was declining about half of the invites I was sending out. So finally, I talked to this person. I just said, what's going on? And again, the faculty member had no idea that all this information was tracked and that this is the process to get onto an editorial board. So again, if it's a journal that's in your specialty and a journal that you will want to be involved in at, you know, a deeper level, you need to really, you know, accept these reviews and do them. Now, don't accept a review invite if you don't have the time to do it. And don't accept a invite if you don't have expertise in that particular topic. So let's say you know you're about to go on vacation out of the country for the next 10 days. Then, yeah, send a little note to the editor. There's usually a box to do that and say, I'm so sorry, I'd love to, you know, review this, but I'm about to be out of the country for 10 days and I won't be able to get it in on time. That's totally acceptable. Or if you don't have expertise. And if you don't have expertise, it's great if you can suggest the name of somebody else who does.
To kind of follow that up a little bit, can you talk about what you look for to get those high scores and all that? Let's say I'm a person that, you know, maybe doesn't get to it and turn around within 24 hours, but what are you looking for when you're rating the reviews and how do you make a good review?
Yeah. Okay. So I would say, number one, you need to remember your role when you're peer reviewing an article. You're not the author. You're the peer reviewer. And that's really important. It's important that you're objective, and again, that you have the expertise in that topic. When looking at the reviews, it's really important to be polite and respectful. I am still to this day shocked when I actually see comments from reviewers that also have inappropriate tone. And so I edit all of those personally, because I don't want any of those comments going out to for example, people on JAMA Surgery who are submitting manuscripts to JAMA Surgery, because I think that reflects on the editor. So you want to be polite. You want to be respectful. You want your comments to be constructive for the manuscript. So are your comments going to make the manuscript better? But yet you still need to be realistic in your comments. So, you know, a good example is if you're reviewing for a super high impact factor journal versus a very low impact factor journal. So you might be a little bit different in what you're recommending for the revision on the two. So be realistic with respect to the impact of the journal, what can be done. And then you also want to be concise. So these really long, verbose reviews where you've got 15 comments, but then each comment's a paragraph, I mean, that's a little excessive. So I'd say be concise. Another thing, when you are the reviewer, is make sure that you actually have no typographical and grammatical errors in your review. It looks bad when the peer reviewer has typographical and grammatical errors. And then I would just say, again, make sure that you do it timely. I mean, there's a lot of resources out there that actually go through how to critically evaluate a manuscript that I think are very, very helpful. And again, if you know how to write a good manuscript, then I also think you'll know how to review a manuscript.
Dr. Kibbe, my next question is, what situations would you contact an editor? And what also on the opposite side of that, what situations should you not contact an editor?
Yeah, so that's a good question. And I actually was just talking to another editor about this. So in general, I would say that editors prefer for you to go through the editorial system because we all have a system in place for that reason. When you have a question that isn't clear, for example, in the instructions for authors or something like that, then that's fine. You'll probably be contacting, you know, the office manager, the managing editor, which is fine. One thing that I think editors probably do not prefer getting are the questions of, hey, can you take a look at this manuscript or this abstract and tell me if you think it's a good fit for your journal? Because really, that's kind of your job as the author. You should, if you are not sure about the fit for a journal, all you need to do is go to the table of contents for the last several issues and really look at the types of manuscripts that are being published in that journal. And then there's also the editorial process that was set up. If you're not sure, just submit it and let it go through the regular peer review process, and you'll find out if it wasn't appropriate, it will probably be sent back to you and rejected very quickly. Now, I was just having this discussion with John Hunter, who's the editor for World Journal of Surgery, and Yeah, he also agreed that, you know, we're all busy and there's a process set up in place and to use the process. Now, a time when I think it is appropriate to email the editor is if you received a review on your manuscript that you honestly believe was not fair because you believe that the reviewer had a conflict or was unduly biased against your manuscript for some reason. And if you really believe that there are comments in your review that were inappropriate, then yeah, email the editor. Sometimes the editors will look at that and they might actually send your manuscript out for yet another review. So I myself have emailed a few editors over the last decade, and I've had, you know, one or two manuscripts that have been turned around that way. And I also have given several manuscripts in this past year at JAMA Surgery a second chance after folks have emailed me. Not always, though, so be careful with that. But yeah, you can email the editors in that case.
You're going to get flooded with emails now.
I already get plenty. I get used the editorial process.
I was wondering if we could talk a little bit about plagiarism. You know, for one thing, I think a lot of people who are writing or just getting started writing manuscripts don't really have a full understanding of what plagiarism is. So I was wondering if we could touch on that a little bit. And also, you know, what's the penalty? What's the penalty for plagiarism, as well as these other things you were talking about, the meat extending, the salami slicing?
Yeah, so flat-out plagiarism is where you're plagiarizing work from other people. And so, you know, literally like the copying and pasting of text from another manuscript in your manuscript. So flat-out plagiarism, I mean, is easily detectable. And again, it amazes me. But the reviewers are the ones that tend to pick this up. But in today's day and age, let me just tell you, most journals now are starting to use software that will actually check for plagiarism. And journals, there's not consistency in how they're using them yet. I know some journals that scan every manuscript that's submitted, so that's the most intensive, and then it spans to other journals that scan the manuscripts that have been accepted or are being considered for acceptance. And so in using the software, it really, you set the limit of, say, the number of similar words in one sequence that you want to detect. So I think a common number is 5. So it'll detect a sequence of 5 similar words in any other publication out there. And then you'll get a similarity index in this report. And it will tell you, okay, there's 1% of the content in this manuscript that's similar with other published manuscripts, or 2%, or 10%, or 20%. And so that's what the software does. And so something that I've personally adopted for all my own publications is, because you never know, if you have other people who are writing the manuscripts, you know, I work with a lot of postdocs and residents. I, on my own, scan these before I submit them anywhere, just to make sure that there's no plagiarism. Now, the area that is harder is self-plagiarism, because self-plagiarism, there's a lot of people out there who may, for example, use a method section from a prior manuscript. So I do basic science research. There's only so many ways you can write up the description for how to do a Western blot analysis. So many journals are a little bit more tolerant of self-plagiarism when it comes to a method section. But let me tell you, I can never find in any manuscript a reason why you would have self-plagiarism in a results section, an introduction, or a discussion section. And that's an issue when you detect self-plagiarism in those, because really a manuscript should be original content. The issue here is that journals own the copyright of published work. And so that is why you cannot, you know, perform self-plagiarism. So I will tell you that several years ago, I myself had an instance of self-plagiarism that I was really embarrassed about. And this was when the software programs were just starting to be used by journals. I was asked to write an update on a clinical topic that I'd written about in the past, a couple of years earlier. So I said, great, no problem. I took my Microsoft Word article, you know, the manuscript that I wrote up from several years earlier. And I basically literally, you know, updated all the different sections. So what happened is I then submitted it to the journal, and I got an email from the editor, and I was horrified because they basically said, Melina, you have 61% self-plagiarism. You need to completely redo this. But I looked at it, and I said, hey, I actually had 39% new content on an update, and I was actually thrilled, but still, because it was an update on something else I'd written. But still, the issue was I had a lot of self-plagiarism from a prior published work, and there's copyright issues at hand. So yeah, I literally had to go through sentence by sentence and edit the entire thing. And that was a little lesson that I learned on self-plagiarism, even when it's a review article and an update. It's challenging because we all kind of write the similar way over and over again.
Yeah, and I could see how it could, I could see how the self-plagiarism thing especially could very easily accidentally happen. Are there resources out there that, anybody can use to kind of, these computer programs to kind of self-check themselves?
Yeah, so I would say that in most academic institutions, you can you can communicate with your department to see if your department has a license for any of these different software programs that can be used. Your library might have a license that you can use, and so there's different ways. You just have to ask around.
Okay. And getting back to that, are there any penalties? Do you keep a record of people that you catch or?
Yeah, so when there's serious, editorial misconduct, so plagiarism, also duplicate publications, things like that, fraud, fabrication, falsification, those are the serious ones. But yeah, there's actually some guidelines that all of the journal editors follow with COPE, and actually you can Google it yourself and you can kind of see the different flow charts that are recommended for how the editorial misconduct is actually processed. Depending on the type of misconduct and the severity of it, it could be handled differently. It can be from as minor as, asking for a revision or going to a correction that gets published online to a retraction. Of course, you can, if it's picked up early on, a rejection of the manuscript. If it's very serious, then in addition to a correction or retraction, then a department chair and or a dean of an institution would be notified. So it just really depends on the type of editorial misconduct that occurs.
Now, ma'am, my question is that, this is maybe a problem we've all struggled with at one point, maybe not Dr. Steele, but, why is it important for residents to be involved in research? We're already overwhelmed with our own clinical duties. What's the benefit in the end game of all that?
Yeah, I think it makes you a better doctor. So depending on the type of research that you do, so we care for patients, right? And our primary goal is to take care of patients. But you want to make sure that you're actually delivering state-of-the-art care to patients. And if you actually conduct research, again, whether it's basic science, translational, clinical outcomes, etc., it means you're asking the right questions about clinical care, trying to answer them, and you're trying to do it hopefully in a hypothesis-driven way. And in the result, you're improving care. At least that's the goal, is that you're improving health care for patients. And in the process of doing this, in addition to improving care through research, you also become a better doctor because you learn how to ask the right questions and you learn how to ask better questions and you learn how to answer the questions yourself. So I'm a true believer, for example, when it comes to residency programs, that whether you're going to have a career, pursuing research or not, I think it's really important to do research in your residency, whether you do it while you're clinical or you take a year or two or three off to do it, because it makes you a better doctor.
Well, Melina, this has been great, and we want to always end like we typically do with people with our final five. Since we've given you a final five in the past, we have come out with the all-new final five part due. So number one, what was your first car?
A 1985 Chevy Sprint.
What color?
Three-cylinder. It was like a little lawnmower.
What color was that?
She was a cherry red, and I actually had her. She was named, but I won't tell you that. But I had her for 19 years. I got her in high school. I drove this little three-cylinder Chevy Sprint through high school, through undergrad. I drove her to Chicago, from California to Chicago. I had her in all undergrad, all of medical school, and then drove her to Pittsburgh and had her all for my residency, drove her back to Chicago, and continued to drive her for the first 2 years of my faculty appointment before I got another car. 19 years. And then I sold her, believe it or not, on eBay. And someone actually bought her.
Awesome. Number two, do you remember back, what was your first surgical case as an intern?
You know what? That's a darn good question. I don't remember my first case, but my first memory is of a carotid endarterectomy with Marsha Webster at University of Pittsburgh. And my memory of that, it was early on, it was probably in the first month or two. The reason I remember it is because I passed out. It was the classic, you know, I gowned up, was under the lights, I got warm, I was also overexcited because this is the field I wanted to go into, vascular, so I was very excited, and Marshall Webster was the division chief at the time, and I think put all together, I just was overcome, and I literally passed out, and they had to catch me before I fell. One of the most embarrassing moments I've ever had in my residency.
You know, that's nothing. I can tell you that when I was a medical student, they threw a bone at me and let me do this small case on a patient. And the patient was awake in an ambulatory surgery, and I took the towel clamp straight through the towel and clamped this guy's ear while he was awake. So bad things can happen.
Yes.
Number three, John.
Yeah, ma'am. Who was your surgical mentor, either in medical school or when you were a resident?
I've had many. And I would say it goes back to, you know, you should have multiple mentors. So, it's just so many for me to list. I would say that a really dominant person in my residency was Dr. Macaroon. He was the division chief of vascular at Pittsburgh, and he really supported my decision to pursue vascular surgery. I also had Tim Billier, who's the chair at University of Pittsburgh, who really supported me in the lab and helped to develop me as a researcher. And at Northwestern, I would clearly identify as a faculty member my mentor, Bill Pierce, who hired me and really was responsible for creating the environment and providing me the mentoring and the supervision and the support that I needed to really blossom as a surgeon scientist. But there's so many others that I would love to mention. I think it's important that everybody have multiple mentors for different aspects of their career.
Number four, what is the best surgical journal? No, I'm just kidding. What was your greatest...
Gamma Surgery!
I thought I'd throw you a plug there. What is your greatest athletic achievement?
Oh, okay. That's easy because I'm not athletic. And a few years ago, in 2012, I was pressured, I would say serious peer pressure, to climb a mountain, which I've never done in my life, and I will never do ever again. But we were going to a meeting in Malaysia, and so I actually did climb to the top of Mount Kinabalu and made it back down. Not everyone did, I want to tell you that, but it killed me. It nearly killed me, and I will never do it again.
All right, last question, number five. If you could sit down and have dinner with anyone, living or dead, who would it be and why?
Does it have to be real? Because I have a very immediate answer to that.
Oh, go for it.
Yeah, let's hear it.
Jean-Luc Picard.
Wow. Okay, why?
Oh, my God. He is totally like my ideal version of a mentor and someone I would love to talk to. I mean, I just think that as far as his character, for those who don't know, Jean-Luc Picard is a captain of Star Trek Next Generation. And I just think that he represents everything that I strive to be. And so that would be the person.
Well, we can't thank you enough. I really appreciate you not only coming on once on to Behind the Knife, but a second time. And I, again, I learn something every time with each one of our guests, but have again, learned, as I'm sure John and Jason have, from this kind of behind-the-scenes look at something that for academic surgeries may be boring to some people, but for those of us who like it, it's just wonderful stuff. I would like to close and just ask, is there anything we didn't cover, any kind of take-home follow-up things that you'd say, guys, regarding research or manuscripts or editing, anything, just remember this. Is there any final take-home messages that you want to give our listeners?
Yeah, tell a story. And everything that you do, that you're writing, that you're presenting, it's so important to just tell a story. And if you tell a story, people are going to want to listen. And they're also going to remember if you tell a good story.
Well, from all of us at Behind the Knife, thank you so much and have a wonderful day.
Oh, thank you, guys. Thank you so much. Looking forward to hearing it.
Or I should say, dominate the day.
Just a reminder, we can be found at Twitter at Behind the Knife, on Facebook at Behind the Knife, and on our website at www.behindtheknife.org. We really want this to be an interactive experience, so give us your random fact of the day, your tips and tricks, or topics you want to hear. And we're also going to tweet out who we're interviewing that day, and you guys can send in your questions, and we'll read them live on the show. This podcast can be found on iTunes and any other podcast provider.
All right, looks like count's correct. Sash is closed, and the dressings are on.
Until next time, thank you for joining us on Behind the Knife, the surgery podcast. Dominate the day.